Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Trump v. Slaughter, docket number 25332, decided June 29, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. The Federal Trade Commission is a regulatory agency with vast rulemaking, enforcement, and adjudicatory powers whose five commissioners serve seven-year terms and may be removed by the president only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Shortly after beginning his second term in January 2025, President Trump fired the FTC's two remaining Democratic commissioners, Rebecca Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya, without citing any statutory cause, stating instead that their continued service was inconsistent with his administration's priorities. Slaughter filed suit seeking reinstatement, and the district court granted her motion for summary judgment, declaring the removal unlawful and issuing a permanent injunction. A divided court of appeals denied the government's motion for a stay pending appeal. The Supreme Court stayed the district court's order and granted cert before judgment. The questions presented were, first, whether the statutory removal protections for members of the Federal Trade Commission violate the separation of powers, and, if so, whether Humphrey's executor v. United States, decided in 1935, should be overruled. Second, whether a federal court may prevent a person's removal from public office, either through relief at equity or at law. The court held the FTC's four-cause removal provision is contrary to the separation of powers enshrined in the Constitution. The Constitution vests the executive power in the president and requires that he be able to remove officers who exercise that power on his behalf. The FTC unquestionably exercises executive power through its rulemaking, enforcement, and civil litigation functions and must therefore be subject to the president's control. Humphrey's executor v. United States, to the extent it stands for anything more than the proposition that an agency exercising no executive power may be structured independently, is overruled. Because the FTC's activities fall well within the heartland of executive power, the president was entitled to remove Commissioner Slaughter at will. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, joined by Justices Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, and joined by Justice Thomas as to all but Part 3B. Justice Gorsuch filed a concurring opinion. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to remove these and hope they do not impact your listening experience. To leave us feedback on the show or to learn more about the podcast, please visit so-ordered.org. The following is the opinion of the court in Trump v. Slaughter.
Nearly 250 years ago, the framers decided to vest the executive power in one person, a president of the United States of America. The choice was not made lightly. Within living memory were the long train of abuses and usurpations of a king who reigned as a tyrant. Indeed, several delegates to the Constitutional Convention pushed for a multi-member council instead of unity in the executive magistracy, which they feared would serve as the fetus of monarchy. But unity won out. Our Constitution's drafters knew from experience that a plurality in the executive, the model in use by most states at the time, not only diminishes the activity, secrecy, and dispatch necessary to ensure good government, but tends to conceal faults and destroy responsibility. With just one president in charge, they reasoned, there would be no doubt on whom the blame or the punishment of a pernicious measure ought really to fall. 100 years ago, this court honored the convention's choice in the seminal case of Myers v. United States, decided in 1926. There, we held that the Constitution grants to the President the general administrative control of those executing the laws, including the power of appointment and removal of executive officers. Because no one could execute the laws alone and unaided, Chief Justice Taft explained for the court, the President must be permitted to select those who act for him and remove those for whom he cannot continue to be responsible. To hold otherwise would make it impossible for the President to fulfill his constitutional obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Today we confront one of several regulatory agencies that deviate from this model of presidential supervision, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC. Since its creation in 1914, the FTC has accumulated vast rulemaking, enforcement, and adjudicatory powers under more than 80 statutes. Not only does it promulgate rules that carry the force of law, but it also enforces those rules against private parties, collecting civil penalties in the billions of dollars. Its powers, however, do not belong to the President or his appointees alone. They instead belong to five commissioners, each of whom serves for 7 years and may be removed by the President only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. We hold that such protection from removal is contrary to the separation of powers enshrined in the Constitution. When President Trump began his second term in January 2025, the FTC was led by two Republicans and three Democrats. On his first day in office, he designated a new chair, replacing President Biden's pick. As is customary, the former chair, Lina Khan, resigned her seat a few weeks later, permitting President Trump to appoint a replacement, contingent, of course, on the Senate's advice and consent. In the meantime, however, the FTC would be split down the middle. That split came to an abrupt end in March when President Trump fired the two remaining Democratic commissioners, Rebecca Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya. He did not assert that they were inefficient, neglected their duties, or committed malfeasance in office as the statute required. He instead told them that their continued service on the FTC was inconsistent with his administration's priorities and that they were removed from office pursuant to his authority under Article 2 of the Constitution. Slaughter promptly filed suit against the President and other executive officials, seeking declaratory and injunctive relief to restore her to office. She alleged that her removal was ultra vires, violated the Administrative Procedure Act, and violated the Constitution. The district court agreed, granting Slaughter's motion for summary judgment. It acknowledged that Myers generally permits the President to remove executive officers at will as part of his general administrative control of those executing the laws. But it considered itself bound by Humphrey's Executor v. United States, decided in 1935. That case, the district court explained, carved out an exception to Myers' general rule for the FTC, which the Humphreys Court described as a multi-member expert agency that exercised solely quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial functions. The court declared the President's purported removal ultra vires and issued a permanent injunction barring interference with Ms. Slaughter's right to perform her lawful duties. A divided Court of Appeals denied the government's motion for a stay pending appeal. The panel held that the government has no prospect of success on appeal, as this very issue had been settled by Humphrey's executor. Judge Rao dissented, explaining that Humphrey's executor does not license a headless fourth branch of independent agencies exercising considerable executive power. We stayed the district court's order and granted cert before judgment. The Constitution vests the executive power in a President of the United States of America and instructs that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed. To vest the whole executive power in just one person was not to suggest that he could execute the laws alone and unaided, but it was to establish a hierarchy, a chief magistrate with whom the buck stops, and below him various assistants or deputies who derive their offices from his appointment and remain subject to his superintendence. to remain accountable to the president, those officers must be removable by the president. The idea that one president would be in charge was by no means a foregone conclusion in 1787. Just 10 years earlier, the colonists had thrown off the yoke of King George III and his colonial governors. Now citizens, they had no intention of re-establishing the kingly office by another name. Thus, the flurry of state constitutions that followed the Declaration of Independence made of the gubernatorial magistrate a new kind of creature, a very pale reflection indeed of his regal ancestor. Almost every state had but a nominal governor, who could act only with his council's consent. These early chief executives were little more than chairmen of their executive boards. The framers chose to depart from this model, for they had seen its flaws up close. Common was the complaint that the state's feeble and divided executives left no effectual check for the instability and encroachments of legislatures. For fear of monarchical power, William Livingston lamented, the state's improvidently devised executives too weak and inefficacious to operate with proper energy and vigor. The convention was determined not to make the same mistake. So when delegates objected to unity in the executive magistracy as the fetus of monarchy, others could soundly reply that the concern was quite backward. Instead of being the fetus of monarchy, they explained, unity in the executive was the best safeguard against it, for only a single person could produce the vigor and activity necessary to preserve the Constitution's separation of powers, and only a single person could make the office responsible to the people. Give him an able counsel, and it will thwart him, a weak one, and he will shelter himself under their sanction. Any more than one person in charge, as James Wilson put it, oftener serves to cover than prevent malpractices. That the Constitution forged a new path was not hidden from those who ratified it. Hamilton frankly conceded that only two states thus far have entrusted the executive authority wholly to single men, anticipating Roger Sherman's critique of the Constitution that every other government has a council of advice without which the first magistrate could not act. To Hamilton, however, that was the point. Unlike most states, the federal government would have a vigorous executive who could act with secrecy and dispatch, and would not be able to conceal his faults behind a council. A plurality in the executive, Hamilton argued, tends to conceal faults and destroy responsibility. It often becomes impossible, amidst mutual accusations, to determine on whom the blame or the punishment of a pernicious measure or series of pernicious measures ought really to fall. If the executive power were not placed in a single hand, then the people would be deprived of the two greatest securities they can have for the faithful exercise of any delegated power, the restraints of public opinion and the opportunity of discovering with facility and clearness the misconduct of the persons they trust. In opting for one president, however, the framers did not opt for the president to work alone. They knew, as our first president would write, that it would be impossible for just one man to perform all the great business of the state. So they anticipated that Congress would institute the great departments and allow the president to appoint officers therein to assist him in discharging the duties of his trust. As James Wilson explained at the convention, there can be no good executive without a responsible appointment of officers to execute. These officers were to serve as envoys of the president, not his equals. Their very purpose, after all, was to assist him to discharge his arduous employment, not theirs. As such, the government's ministers were required to exercise their functions in subordination to the executive, whether their tasks were big or small. Hamilton made the same point. The persons to whose immediate management the president's powers are committed ought to be considered as the assistants or deputies of the chief magistrate, and on this account they ought to derive their offices from his appointment, at least from his nomination, and ought to be subject to his superintendence. In so structuring the government, the convention rejected a committee-style executive branch in favor of a unitary and accountable president, standing under law, yet over his department heads. It helped in reaching that conclusion, of course, that everyone at the convention knew who that president would be, the convention's presiding officer, George Washington. Because these officers were subject to the president's superintendence, they had to be removable by him at will. For one, that was just part of what it meant to wield the executive power, as it was understood at the time of ratification. Jefferson wrote as early as 1780 that the power of appointing and removing executive officers is inherent in the executive, as he who appoints may remove. And as to this power, the Constitution's words were chosen carefully. It was the President who would appoint the principal officers of the United States, with the Senate providing advice and consent. In the Federalist No. 66, Hamilton writes, "In all the governments with which we are acquainted, those who hold offices during pleasure are dependent on the pleasure of those who appoint them. If the framers intended to depart from this convention, one might have expected them to say so. For another, the power to remove at will was a necessary corollary of the Constitution's design. The unity of the executive branch would be destroyed," Hamilton wrote, "if it were vested ostensibly in one man, subject in whole or in part to the control and cooperation of others, in the capacity of counselors to him. But that is precisely what would occur if the president's so-called assistants could exercise his power against his wishes. Only if the president's deputies were removable at will would they truly be subordinate to the sole executive magistrate. And only then could the Constitution live up to James Iredell's boast that the president would be personally responsible for everything." Text and structure thus both taught that the president had to be able to remove those who failed to live up to their duties, lest he fail to live up to his. This aspect of the president's role was confirmed in the Constitution's first year and in the years that followed. The result was a regular course of practice that liquidated and settled the president's power of removal, a construction followed by every branch of the general government through all the vicissitudes of party. That practice began in the first Congress. When it first met in 1789, one of its first and most pressing tasks was to establish the first executive departments, and with them the first heads of departments. In doing so, it debated how those officers should be removed. Some felt that the Senate had to consent to all removals as one of the two entities that appointed the official in the first place. Others argued that the Constitution was silent on the question, giving Congress the right to select whether an officer may be removed, and if so, by whom, the President and Senate, or the legislature, or any other person whom they might introduce into office, merely for that particular purpose. And a third group contended that removal was part of the executive power vested in the president, which the legislature has no right to diminish or modify. By this point, the arguments made by the third group will sound familiar. Madison led the charge. "I conceive that if any power whatsoever is in its nature executive, and thus vested in the president, it is the power of appointing, overseeing, and controlling those who execute the laws. And if that is so," he explained, "then the power of removal from office must follow. For it is only with that power that the chain of dependence can be preserved, the lowest officers, the middle grade, and the highest made to depend, as they ought, on the president, and the president on the community." Others agreed. Some focused on text. "The power of removal is an executive power," Representative George Clymer said, "and as such belongs to the president alone by the express words of the Constitution." Others focused on structure. "The Constitution places all executive power in the hands of the president," Representative Fisher Ames explained, "and could he personally execute all the laws, there would be no occasion for establishing auxiliaries. But in order that he may be responsible to his country," he continued, "he must have a choice in selecting his assistants, a control over them, with power to remove them when he finds the qualifications which induce their appointment cease to exist." The third group emerged victorious. they successfully convinced the House of Representatives to delete a clause in the draft bill that said that the Secretary of Foreign Affairs was to be removable by the President, for such language would have the appearance of conferring the power upon him when in fact it was his all along. What they favored instead, and what they got, was a new clause that assumed the power of removal to be in the President, so as to establish a legislative construction of the Constitution. The bill, as amended, passed the House and then the Senate, a feat that was repeated first with laws establishing the Department of War and then again with the Treasury. These statutes thus implicitly endorsed the view that the President had a constitutional power to remove executive officers. Congress's confirmation of the President's power quickly took hold and even gained fame as the decision of 1789. After very long debates, Madison wrote to Jefferson, "Congress had endorsed the view that the executive function of removal was vested in the President, a decision most consonant to the text of the Constitution and to the requisite responsibility and harmony in the executive department." Even those who opposed Congress's decision recognized that the decision had been made. Take Representative Richard Bland Lee, who had argued that the question of who may remove officers was up to the legislature, as it could create and establish offices as it saw fit. After the bills had been enacted, Lee wrote that it was determined in the affirmative that the President had, or ought to have, from a fair construction of the Constitution, the power to remove his own appointees. And even those far removed from the debates saw the issue as settled, including Chief Justice Marshall, Chancellor Kent, and Justice Story. See the Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, 1833, in which Justice Story said, expressing doubts about the decision from first principles, but noting that the public acquiesced in this decision and that it has not been questioned on many other occasions. Early presidents of all persuasions, too, hewed to the decision of 1789. Washington saw it as his indispensable duty to remove officers who failed to live up to his expectations. His cabinet agreed, taking the stance that the ability to remove from office was an essential attribute of executive power. The first President Adams said the same, noting his support for the President's power of removal, according to the Constitution in his writings. So did Jefferson, noting in his writings, the power to remove executive officers is inherent in the executive. So did Madison, stating in his writings, one of the constitutional attributes of the executive is to determine the tenure of the office of subordinates. So did Monroe, along with the second President Adams. And so did Jackson, much to Congress's dismay. Unlike his predecessors, who, except for Jefferson, utilized their removal power sparingly, Jackson fired hundreds of subordinates for personal and partisan reasons. But even Jackson's most vehement critics acknowledged that he had the power to do as he pleased. "I consider it a settled point," Senator Daniel Webster said, "settled by construction, settled by precedent, settled by the practice of the government, and settled by statute." When Webster tried to unsettle the decision of 1789 through new legislation, the effort failed, only further cementing the President's power. As Webster, still in the Senate, put it 15 years later, "since the practice has become a settled practice, since every administration has indulged in it, and since it must now be considered as the legal construction of the Constitution, it follows that this power, thus legally vested in the President, must be exercised by him as independently of our control as any other power that is to be exercised by him under the Constitution. What text, history, and structure settle, our precedent confirms, the President may remove his subordinates at will." Twice in the 19th century, we reaffirmed what the first Congress had held. The text of the Constitution is silent with respect to the power of removal from office, we noted in our first case on the subject. But it was very early adopted as the practical construction of the Constitution that the power to remove, where the tenure of the office was not fixed by the Constitution, was vested in the President alone. And such would appear to have been the legislative construction of the Constitution, too, given the organization of the three great departments in the year 1789. Our second case was of a piece. The decision of Congress in 1789 and the universal practice of the government under it, we explained, has settled the question beyond any power of alteration. Parsons v. United States, decided in 1897. Our landmark decision, however, came 100 years ago in Myers v. United States. That case arose from an unlikely source, a dispute over management of the office in Portland, Oregon. Under an 1876 statute, the president had to receive the advice and consent of the Senate not only to appoint postmasters, but also to remove them. For reasons that are now lost to history, President Wilson fired Portland's postmaster, Frank Myers, and did so without the Senate's consent. Myers sued for back pay. In a scholarly opinion, Chief Justice Taft rejected Myers' suit and reaffirmed the president's power to fire his subordinates at will. That power arose, he wrote for the court, from the Constitution's text, history, and structure, just as the first Congress had held in 1789. The vesting of the executive power in the president was essentially a grant of the power to execute the laws, Chief Justice Taft explained. As he is charged specifically to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, the reasonable implication, he continued, was that as part of his executive power, he must be able to remove those for whom he cannot continue to be responsible. Mr. Madison and his associates made this same point, the Chief Justice noted, and they dwelt at length upon the necessity there was for construing Article II to give the President the sole power of removal in his responsibility for the conduct of the executive branch. But Chief Justice Taft emphasized that it was not just the first Congress that had come to this conclusion. The first Congress supplied a precedent upon which many future laws would be based, and if it had erred, the next Congresses would have dissented and departed from its view. Quite the opposite occurred, the Chief Justice explained. The decision of 1789 was soon accepted as a final decision of the question by all branches of the government. For 74 years, there was no act of Congress, no executive act, and no decision of this court at variance with the declaration of the first Congress. In the wake of the Civil War, Chief Justice Taft noted, Congress sought to reverse this constitutional construction, but in the end only confirmed it. This reversal grew out of the serious political differences between President Johnson, a Jacksonian Democrat, and congressional Republicans, who boasted a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. Over Johnson's veto, Congress sought to curtail the then-acknowledged powers of the president with the Tenure of Office Act, which required him to receive the Senate's consent before firing most officers. The injury and invalidity of the law was immediately recognized by the executive and objected to, and not just by Johnson. General Grant, succeeding Mr. Johnson in the presidency, and no fan of Johnson or his program, earnestly recommended in his first message the total repeal of the law. What faith can an executive put in officials forced upon him? Grant asked. How will such officials be likely to serve an administration which they know does not trust them? Despite Grant's efforts, the feeling growing out of the controversy with President Johnson retained the act on the statute book and led to one other such law, the one for postmasters at issue in that very case until 1887, when the Tenure in Office Act was repealed. What these events revealed, Chief Justice Taft wrote, was not presidential acquiescence, but resistance, a consistent rejection of the validity of such legislation as incompatible with the legislative action of 1789. At issue in Myers, then, as the Chief Justice saw it, was whether to set aside the first Congress's construction, thus buttressed, and adopt an adverse view, contrary to the Constitution's text, history, and structure. The court refused to do so. It hewed instead to the constitutional construction reached by the first Congress of the United States and acquiesced in by the whole government for three quarters of a century. Any law to the contrary, the court concluded, was in violation of the Constitution and invalid. While Myers was perhaps our best word on the subject, it was not our last. Just 9 years after Myers, we handed down Humphrey's executor. The case arose out of President Roosevelt's decision to fire one of President Hoover's appointees to the Federal Trade Commission, William Humphrey, 2 years into Humphrey's 7-year term. Humphrey lauded Hoover as the foremost figure of the world, a man who fought back against the demagogue, the fanatic, the reformer, and the fool. On the commission, Humphrey sought to do the same. He often spoke to the press and described the FTC variously as a publicity bureau used to spread socialistic propaganda, a bureaucracy gone insane, and an instrument of oppression and disturbance and injury. Roosevelt saw matters differently and requested Humphrey's resignation. Humphrey refused, so Roosevelt fired him in a one-line letter that did not specify a cause for his removal, seemingly contrary to a statute permitting removal of commissioners only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Humphrey died soon thereafter, and the executor of his estate sued for back pay. On a day that new dealers would dub Black Monday, the court ruled unanimously against the president, as it did in two other cases decided that same day. Schechter Poultry Corporation v. United States and Louisville Joint Stock Land Bank v. Radford. Schechter and Radford were quite a blow to the president, invalidating aspects of his signature legislation. Schechter found an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power in a statute that gave the president free rein to prescribe standards of fair competition business was obliged to follow. And Radford found a violation of the Takings Clause in a statute that allowed farmers who defaulted on their mortgages to retain possession of their property for years on end. Having to contend with Myers, Humphrey said far less. Justice Sutherland, writing for the court, started by reaffirming that the president possesses the exclusive and illimitable power to remove all purely executive officers, just as Myers held. He then pivoted. There are some presidentially appointed officials, he explained, who may perform executive functions but exercise no part of the executive power. And for those officials, the decision in the Myers case cannot be accepted as controlling. The court held that William Humphrey was one such official. That was because the FTC's duties were very limited. They were neither political nor executive, but predominantly quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative. When courts requested the FTC's help as a master in chancery to recommend appropriate remedies in antitrust litigation, for instance, it acted solely as a judicial aid. When Congress requested the FTC's help to make investigations and reports on certain topics, it acted solely as a legislative aid. And when it brought and adjudicated charges against corporations it suspected of using unfair methods of competition in commerce, it acted in part quasi-legislatively and in part quasi-judicially. Because these quasi-functions did not require the use of executive power, Justice Sutherland reasoned, Humphrey needed to answer only to Congress and the courts. Although the president may be the master in his own house, he warned, he may not impose his control in the house of another. From the start, Humphreys was tethered to a highly circumscribed and almost fictional view of the FTC's role. Humphreys, by its terms, applied only to agencies that occupy no place in the executive department, are independent of executive authority, and exercise no part of the executive power. Indeed, Justice Sutherland took pains to emphasize that the character of the office, executive or non-executive, would determine the result of future cases, and to reiterate that the court's decision was limited to officers of the kind here under consideration. In later cases, although Humphrey's announced dividing line remained intact, more and more functions, we concluded, in fact, fell on the executive side of that line, and thus within the president's exclusive control. Where Humphrey suggested that the power to enforce the law against particular parties could be merely quasi-judicial or in aid of federal courts, we held the opposite. A lawsuit is the ultimate remedy for a breach of the law, we explained in 1976, and it is to the president and not to the Congress that the Constitution entrusts the responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. and where Humphrey suggested that the power to fill in the details of a general standard could be merely quasi-legislative or an aid of Congress, we again held the opposite. Although some administrative agency action may resemble lawmaking, we explained in 1983, when an agency exercises legislatively delegated authority to regulate private conduct, it exercises executive power. Soon enough, we recognized that Humphreys flunked even its own test. It is hard to dispute that the powers of the FTC, even at the time of Humphreys' executor, we explained in 1988, would at the present time be considered executive, at least to some degree. Not one for understatement, Justice Scalia observed in dissent that the court had swept Humphreys into the dustbin of repudiated constitutional principles. The court put the matter more delicately, but no less definitively. We undoubtedly did rely on the terms quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial in Humphreys, the court noted, but our present considered view is that the constitutional question cannot be made to turn on such rigid categories, at least for inferior officers. Fast forward another few decades, and Humphrey's premises had been further undermined. In two cases, Free Enterprise Fund v. Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and CELA Law v. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we again considered the permissibility of restrictions on the president's power of removal. In both cases, we reiterated Myers's rule that the president exercises general administrative control of those executing the laws and thus must be able to remove those for whom he cannot continue to be responsible. In both cases, we emphasized that Humphreys had to be read on its own terms and thus applies only to agencies that perform specified duties as a legislative or as a judicial aid. And in both cases, we refused to extend Humphreys to a new situation in Free Enterprise Fund, two layers of for-cause removal within an agency, and in CELA Law, for-cause removal protection for the sole head of an agency. As we put it in CELA Law, Humphreys is not a freestanding invitation for Congress to limit the president's constitutional power. Humphreys' framework, in short, has not withstood the test of time. While Humphreys was surely right to focus on the character of the office at issue, and surely right to say that purely executive powers must be controlled by the president, we long ago abandoned the notion that there are some powers that are only partly executive. 40 years have now passed, in fact, since we recognized that the FTC exercises executive power, and did so even in 1935, when Humphreys was decided. And more than 200 years have passed since we recognized that the Constitution vests the whole executive power in the president alone. At this point, all that is left of Humphreys is its observation that an agency that exercises no part of the executive power need not fall within the rule of presidential removal. See Mistretta v. United States, explaining that Humphreys stands only for the proposition that there would be no strict constitutional impediment to a branchless agency that exercises no governmental power. If Congress wishes to establish independent agencies to assist it with its functions, it may do so, but it may not foist those agencies upon the president and thus deprive him of the executive power vested in him by the Constitution, something Humphreys itself never purported to permit. If anything more is left of Humphreys, we overrule it. Humphreys has for decades been a result in search of a rationale. As we have often said, stare decisis is not an inexorable command and is at its weakest in constitutional cases where only we may readily fix our own mistakes. Our precedents about precedent teach that a number of factors are relevant. Here, every factor, the quality of the decision's reasoning, its consistency with our other cases, the workability of its rule, and the interests of those who have relied on it. Humphreys has been difficult to make sense of from the start. Only by blind feats of definition could the court transform powers that are quintessentially executive, investigative, and prosecutorial alike into non-executive, quasi-legislative, and quasi-judicial functions. As Justice Jackson memorably put it, Humphrey's retreat to the qualifying quasis is implicit with confession that all recognized classifications have broken down, and quasis is a smooth cover which we draw over our confusion as we might use a counterpane to conceal a disordered bed. When an agency executes a congressional mandate against private parties, it exercises executive power, no ifs, ands, or quasi about it. For that reason, Humphreys is now far out of step with our cases, which have all but limited it to its facts. We long ago retreated from Humphreys. We applied it only once, in 1958, to a solely adjudicatory body that dealt with a limited category of claims for compensation from those imprisoned or interned in the Second World War. And even then, our constitutional analysis spanned only one brisk paragraph, as the case focused on the question whether the statute limited the president's power at all. Since then, we have undermined Humphrey's premises at every turn. To persist in Humphrey's would require us to depart from almost every case on the subject we have decided since. Little surprise, then, that no one knows how to apply Humphrey's in practice. Does it protect all multi-member agencies, or only those that are balanced along partisan lines, those that wield some executive power but not a lot, or only those that do not wield the president's conclusive and preclusive powers? Or perhaps it is only those that are materially indistinguishable from the 1935 FTC. With its indeterminacy and unpredictability, Humphreys has undermined the very rule of law values that stare decisis exists to secure. All that is left is reliance, upon which Slaughter and the dissent rely. Slaughter argues that Congress has relied upon Humphreys to create agencies that are insulated from presidential control. That is precisely the problem. Despite what Humphreys may say, independent agencies are not independent in the sense that they are free of the president and thus responsive only to the people of the United States. Independent agencies are insulated from the president, not from politics. As a practical matter, successful insulation of administration from the president, even if accomplished in the name of independence, will tend to enhance Congress's own authority over the insulated activities, placing the power to administer laws in officers who enjoy freedom from presidential oversight and protection. In other words, does not deliver us to a promised land of technocratic governance. It often results only in an increased subservience to congressional direction. Congress may well have relied on Humphreys in taking more power for itself, but that is hardly one of the legitimate reliance interests that our precedents contemplate. No branch may rely on adverse possession to claim power that the Constitution vests elsewhere. The dissent contends that we ignore the reliance interests of ordinary Americans and regulated firms alike. Quite the contrary. In its valiant search for reliance interests, it is the dissent that somehow misses maybe the most important one, the reliance interests of the American people in the preservation of our constitutionally promised liberties. The diffusion of power carries with it a diffusion of accountability. When power is exercised well, the people know whom to thank. When power is exercised poorly, they know whom to blame and whom to fire. That is the very premise of our system of government. In The Federalist No. 70, Hamilton writes, "The ingredients which constitute safety in the Republican sense are a due dependence on the people and a due responsibility." We adhere to that system today, not in spite of the reliance interests of all Americans, but because of them. With these principles in mind, this is not a close case. The FTC's for-cause removal provision violates the separation of powers. In its present form, the FTC enforces and administers some 80 statutes, which cover almost every facet of our nation's economy. The tasks it undertakes are the very essence of execution of the law, precisely the president's constitutional role. First, the FTC has the power to promulgate substantive rules that carry the force of law. In the consumer protection realm, for instance, the FTC is tasked with giving content to the startlingly abstract idea of acts or practices which are unfair or deceptive. In other areas, it must, for example, determine what documentary material and information one company must provide when it wishes to acquire another, decide when and how websites must seek verifiable parental consent when their services collect children's personal information, and prescribe as necessary or appropriate in the public interest or for the protection of United States citizens' rules barring the use of any manipulative technique in the sale of gasoline. The power to flesh out such statutory regimes, and to do so through discretionary actions, largely outside the remit of courts, is executive through and through. Second, the FTC not only investigates businesses to ensure they comply with its statutes and rules, but enforces those statutes and rules through in-house adjudications. Indeed, it may even place the onus on a private party to comply with its orders, on pain of monetary penalties, before the case reaches the courts. This power, too, is executive. And third, the FTC files civil suits on behalf of the United States in federal court. It may select its remedies freely, from injunctions to civil penalties to any relief necessary to redress injury to consumers, including the refund of money or return of property. As we have said many times, the discretionary power to seek judicial relief lies at the very core of executive authority. That quintessentially executive power may not be cleaved off from the executive branch. The FTC unquestionably exercises executive power and must therefore be controlled by the chief executive in whom such power is vested. It follows then that Slaughter served as the president's subordinate at the FTC and that the president was entitled to cut her tenure short. Because the FTC's activities fall well within the heartland of executive power, we have no occasion today to define the bounds of what such power entails. As our precedents recognize, not all offices created by Congress necessarily come with executive or even sovereign power attached. To suggest otherwise would come as a surprise to, among other congressionally chartered entities, the Boy Scouts of America, the Society of American Florists and Ornamental Horticulturalists, and Georgetown University. Relatedly, we have left open the possibility that some functions traditionally handled outside the executive branch may not be encompassed by Myers's general rule. Indeed, Myers itself placed the greatest weight on the early Congresses and early presidents' contemporaneous legislative exposition of the executive's constitutional role. And one example we have given of an entity that may have such a unique role is the Federal Reserve, to the extent that it follows in the distinct historical tradition of the first and second banks of the United States, both of which influenced monetary policy and neither of which were subject to plenary presidential control. Our prior cases do not necessarily implicate the constitutionality of such arrangements. Our opinion today should not be read to do so either, nor do we determine the fate of officials not before us. In particular, as the Solicitor General recognized at argument, the permissibility of tenure protections for the judges of non-Article III courts, such as the Tax Court and the Court of Federal Claims, is not presented or briefed in this case and poses a different set of questions. We leave those questions for another day. All we do today is recognize what has been clear for a century, that those who fall within the President's general administrative control must be removable by the President at will. Although she disagrees with our conclusion, Slaughter at least accepts many of our premises. She agrees, for instance, that officers with purely executive functions, like the postmaster in Myers, must be removable at will by the President. She agrees that CELA law is correct. And she agrees that the vesting clause of Article II establishes a general default presidential removal power. The dissent, on the other hand, sweeps the chess pieces off the board, rejecting not only Free Enterprise Fund and CELA law, but Myers and the decision of 1789 as well. On its view, there is no evidence that those who shaped or ratified the Constitution adopted the general rule of at-will removal, no matter the view expressed by Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton in the first years of the Republic, no matter the practice of the first Congress and all our early presidents, and no matter the convention's insistence upon unity in the executive. To support its own position, the dissent relies on two passing comments in The Federalist. Neither one helps. In Federalist No. 39, Madison noted that the tenure of ministerial offices will be a subject of legal regulation, but it beggars belief to suggest that he intended so obliquely to permit Congress to hem in the president. It is far more likely that he intended only to endorse regulation of tenure in the sense of a limited term for executive officers, subject to presidential removal in the interim. And in Federalist No. 77, Hamilton said that the Senate's consent would be necessary to displace as well as to appoint, but it remains a subject of scholarly debate whether Hamilton meant displace in the sense of remove or replace. Certainly, the idea that the Senate could force a new president to keep his predecessor's cabinet secretaries is at odds with Hamilton's claim that the Senate cannot themselves choose who will fill an office, even if they withheld their assent to the president's pick. At odds with Hamilton's claim that the executive power is vested in one man and is not subject to the control and cooperation of others, and at odds with Hamilton's claim that executive officers are the assistants or deputies of the chief magistrate and thus must derive their offices from his nomination and remain subject to his superintendence. Whatever Hamilton meant at first, by 1793, he had expressly recognized that the power of removal from office forms part of the executive power of the nation vested in the president. We see little reason why one line, really one word, from Federalist No. 77 should take precedence over the logic of the Federalist as a whole. We certainly see no reason why it should take precedence over the decision of 1789. When it comes to those debates, the dissent has little to offer, beyond its efforts to limit the decision's scope. Says the dissent, the House in 1789 did not address whether Congress could place any limits on the president's power to remove, for it debated only whether the president had such a power at all. The two, however, are one and the same. In holding that the president has the power to remove his subordinates without an express grant from Congress, Congress held that the power of removal forms part of the executive power. And to the extent that the power of removal is part of the executive power, it is as much outside Congress's control as the president's power to grant pardons, veto bills, and recognize foreign sovereigns. See Schick v. Reed, decided in 1974, holding a presidential power that flows from the Constitution cannot be modified, abridged, or diminished by the Congress. That is why no one at the time saw the first Congress as having endorsed merely a default presidential removal power, if such a thing is not a contradiction in terms. Madison, in fact, said just the opposite. Because the executive power vested in the president includes the power to remove from office, he explained, the legislature has no right to diminish or modify that power. Chief Justice Marshall agreed, explaining that the decision of 1789 viewed the president's power of removal as fixed in the Constitution and thus free from legislative instability. The same was true for Justice Story, who said that the decision expressed the sense of the legislature, that the power of removal by the executive of principal officers could not be abridged by the legislature. With no support in the first Congress's actual debate on the subject, the dissent, this time joined by Slaughter, turns to three early agencies that it contends were at least semi-independent. But the members of these agencies, too, were removable by the president at will. Indeed, the first of the three, the Revolutionary War Debt Commission, was composed solely of presidential appointees, with a statute that did not purport to limit the president's power of removal. And the latter two, the Mint Board and the Sinking Fund Commission, were both composed mostly of cabinet secretaries, who all agree could be fired at any time. The only question arises as to one member of the Mint Board, the Chief Justice, and two members of the Sinking Fund Commission, the Chief Justice and the Vice President. Of course, the President could not fire either one from his underlying position, but that did not mean that he was unable to oust them from service within the executive branch itself. It is true that the president could not add a new vice president or chief justice to replace them, but that poses no constitutional problem. Either way, the president remains responsible. If he chooses to keep them in office, he is responsible for their conduct. If he chooses to remove them, he is responsible for the conduct of those who are left. Certainly, these examples do not show that the founding-era Congress thought that it could take away the president's power and give it to someone else, much less the Chief Justice or the Vice President. With no support in the founding-era as a whole, the dissent opts to skip ahead a century or two. Today, the dissent notes, dozens of agencies are headed by commissioners or board members removable only for cause, and this long-standing practice, it contends, should be entitled to significant weight. We have never endorsed such a practice, makes perfect theory of congressional power, and in fact rejected it in INS v. Chadha, decided in 1983. At issue in Chadha were the nearly 300 legislative vetoes adopted by the political branches over the course of 50 years, with more and more enacted each year. As we saw matters, however, the popularity of the congressional veto only sharpened our review. Such political inventions must remain subject to the demands of the Constitution, we said, lest the political branches amend by agreement integral parts of the constitutional design. We say the same today. To bolster its reliance on modern practice, the dissent focuses on a modern case, Humphreys. But it defends a version of Humphreys that does not exist. On the dissent's telling, Humphreys makes this a profoundly easy case, as Humphreys squarely holds that Congress may forbid presidential removals for an agency of this character. Only halfway through a footnote does the dissent acknowledge that Humphreys described the FTC in 1935 as sharing no part of the executive power, which presumably forms part of an agency's character. Nowhere does the dissent argue, however, that the FTC today exercises no part of the executive power, or, to quote further from Humphreys, that the FTC occupies no place in the executive department and ought to be independent of executive authority. The dissent may not keep the parts of Humphreys it likes and discard the rest. Indeed, the dissent's ode to stare decisis is hard to reconcile with its reinvention of Humphreys and shabby treatment of Myers. At least we have accorded Humphreys a respectful burial. The dissent would cast Myers aside without a second thought. It is entitled to propose as much, of course, but it can hardly claim the mantle of stare decisis in doing so. When it comes to its own proposal for how precisely Humphreys should work in practice, the dissent says very little. Slaughter, for her part, is left with the vague argument that we should police Congress's decisions for reasonableness. If Congress reasonably decides that the president should be able to remove some duly appointed officers only for certain causes and through certain processes, she argues, the court should respect that decision and require that the president discharge his obligations under the Take Care Clause by going through those processes when warranted. That supposed limiting principle is neither limiting nor much of a principle. On Slaughter's view, and presumably the dissent's, Congress could commandeer the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services, most, if not all, of the Department of Justice, and a number of other agencies besides. Indeed, it is not clear to us why Congress would need to allow the president any say in firings. If it is so critical for an agency to have independence and to act with impartiality free from the suspicion of partisan direction, then why should the president have a role at all? Certainly those legislators who disagreed with the decision of 1789 were happy to leave him out. See Annals of Congress with Representative Sedgwick, arguing that Congress may vest the removal power in the president and Senate, or the legislature, or any other person whom they might introduce into office, merely for that particular purpose. The answer, then as now, is that these officers exercise the president's power, not their own, and thus must be responsible to him. We do not allow intrusions on Article 1 nor on Article 3. We see no reason to allow intrusions on Article 2 either. Our Constitution creates three branches, but only one president. That president is not all-powerful, not by any means, but he is not impotent either. He and he alone is vested with the executive power of the United States. To discharge the duties of his trust, the president must have the assistance of officers he can trust. Although it is up to the Senate to decide whether to confirm those with whom the president would prefer to work, neither Congress nor the courts may saddle him with those with whom he cannot work. Subordinates who exercise the president's power are subject to removal by him. Then, and only then, can they remain accountable to the president and the president to the people. The judgment of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered,